I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from the Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow the Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Hey, what's going on? This is Rad with another awesome episode of Soft Rep Radio. And today's episode is even more special. Not only is it Soft Rep's 10th anniversary of being a website, bringing you media from within the special operations community and abroad, but it's also a sensitive time for those that are around this website who have lost friends in the Benghazi attack. So it's been about 10 years, September 11th, 2012, everybody has heard about Benghazi, and if you haven't, well, we're about to talk about what happened on the ground in Benghazi, and I have former diplomat Ethan Chorin on with me today to talk about his time on the ground with extensive knowledge of the region of Libya, and welcome to the show. Happy to have you, Ethan.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
I really just want to jump off and talk about your book real quick. Tell me the title of your book from your mouth so we can hear it, please.
The simple title is just Benghazi! And the subtitle is long. It's a new history of the fiasco that pushed America and its world to the brink. And I'm not completely responsible for that subtitle, but it does the job.
Yes, and I wanted to hear it from you because I read it so many different ways before we had our conversation, the title, and it's like, I want to hear you say it, right? So while you're listening, go check out that book wherever books are sold, all right, and get into what we're about to talk about. Now, Ethan, as I mentioned, this is a sensitive time. You know, we not only have the anniversary of, you know, the Benghazi attacks that happened in 2012, we also have the anniversary of 9/11 that happened to us coming up as well. And that really is what kicked off, you know, the 11-year fight from 2001 to 2012 for us getting involved in a lot of global war on terror. Where were you at when 9/11 happened?
Where was I? I was visiting my parents in California and had just made a, I remember very vividly, as every most people do, I just made a cup of coffee and all of a sudden I heard my mother scream, "Come here, watch this." And then, of course, we watched as the second tower was hit.
Yeah, same. I'm in that same boat. My dad came upstairs. He's like, "Aaron, turn the TV on." I was like, "Okay." We woke up, turned the TV on. The first tower was already hit, you know, and then all of a sudden we just saw maybe like a moment later, just the second one. And my dad looked at me and said, "Okay, we're under attack." And I was like, "Oh, geez, Dad, you don't talk like that. Former Green Beret, you don't talk like that." And he talked like that. And so, you know, that's where I was. That's where you were. What a defining moment in our lifetime. Would you not agree that's a very big thing that happened while we were alive?
Yes, it was certainly a earth-shaking event. I would argue maybe that our some of our reaction to it was provoked a response, provoked other things that might have been better controlled, should I say. But it certainly set off a series of events that has profoundly changed the world as we know it.
100% today. And so what I'm trying to lead into is that 9/11 was devastating. And it's not to be, you know, overshrouded by another 9/11, right? And that's not what we're trying to talk about. We're trying to talk about an attack that happened in Libya while September 11th, September 10th, you were in country in Libya when that attack happened. Tell me your routine. You get on the plane, you show your special, you have a special passport, right? Is it maroon at the time? What color is your passport?
Well, the diplomatic passports were black. But at the time, I was only in the Foreign Service for about 4.5 years. So when I went back to Libya starting in 2011, up to the attack, I was there as a private person. I'd started a small NGO that was focusing on medical reconstruction, basically, or support after the intervention, and you know, with a Libyan-American colleague and some very loose coordination with Chris Stevens, the ambassador.
So you were getting a business up and going independent.
At the time, I was not a diplomat. I was a regular citizen. But, you know, Chris Stevens invited me over for dinner the night of the attack. And, you know, I couldn't help, but I demurred at the time. I remember saying something like, or at least thinking that, you know, "Hey, Chris, you've got lots of security over there, and we're unprotected." And of course, anybody visiting the U.S. compound in Benghazi or anywhere in the region, you know, can draw attention. So, but of course, little did I know that, in fact, he didn't have as much protection as he should have. But that, you know, the idea that I might have been there and that my colleagues might have been there as well is truly frightening. And I was tremendously upset by the whole experience. Chris was a friend. We had a sort of an unusual correspondent relationship for years. I had been in Libya before his first tour there, and he had called me up and asked me what I thought of Libya and the posting there because he was considering it. And I knew that we both, it was the kind of environment that we both thrived on. And I had the opportunity to sit down with him a few months before the attack as he was being confirmed as ambassador or waiting to be confirmed. And I recall that he had expressed his frustrations with the pace of things and that he really wanted to, he was concerned that Benghazi was going downhill fast from a security perspective and that the United States had sort of limited time to get a grip on this and to have a positive impact. So that conversation also stayed in my mind.
Now, from things that have been put on the big box that we watch at home, and from my perspective, I've heard that he wanted to go over with a small security detail to not really make a big presence that he was there during that, you know, tension-built time in Benghazi where he knew it was a fragile situation, right? And so is that my understanding? Is he was kind of wanting a small detail just to move in kind of clandestine?
Well, I think Ambassador Stevens, Chris, as I knew him, was certainly very mindful of the fact that moving around places like Benghazi, you don't want to draw lots of attention to yourself. And there's a, you know, probably no real good balance between being protected and not drawing excessive attention to yourself. So, you know, there were various, as this has been gone into in various different forums, but you know, there were specific circumstances around that that particular trip, which one can get deeply into, which are, you know, very unfortunate. But yeah, I mean, I felt after the attack that Chris's decisions were sort of unfairly and understandably, I mean, one can understand why he became a lightning rod and maybe to some extent a place to put some of the anger and fear that people had. But you know, I did not see him as the he was a risk taker, but not without reason.
So a premeditated thinker. So he was thinking his thoughts.
This was not a decision that he took lightly. I mean, I also interviewed for the book many people who were with him just before and in the hours and the days before the attack. I'd been texting and speaking with him in the day before the days before the attack as well. So I have some, even though I was not a direct eyewitness, as in I wasn't on the compound at the time, I was sensing what was going on just before, and I was on the phone with people who were in contact with his people and had just been in contact with some of his security people before the attack, and was on the phone with one of his security people while the attack was going on. And then, you know, I was actually physically at a hotel about 3 kilometers away, which served as one of Chris's early bases while he was an envoy, and which would be the sort of the other place where, well, some strange things were going on around the hotel at the time. And it was just a surreal scene. I describe in the book, in the first chapter, basically the first long prologue chapter is sort of my view of what happened from the day I left Istanbul on a flight to Benghazi and then building up to the attack. And it's not the sort of security eye view, the commando eye view that we're mostly familiar with. It's what I saw.
Well, you're working for the country as a diplomat, so commando up all you want, sir. All right, let me just tell you that. I talked to another guy.
Well, at the time I wasn't.
No, that's true. You were just a regular individual living your life, trying to open up a business to help the people over there with medical equipment. So I wanted to point that out, that there was a point to where you were able to try to create a business, get it going, work with the locals, have handshakes with businessmen in that industry, in that area. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Muammar Gaddafi's son, okay, who also was trying to like stop anything from happening. And a lot of people were coming at him, and he was very West centralized with a lot of his talk. And he was a younger man. I mean, I believe he got captured, et cetera, where he's at, I'm not sure. And then his father was found to be, and you know, captured and killed and dragged through the streets. Now, I'm saying that up until Benghazi, you were over there leading kind of a normal life, trying to get a business running, correct?
Well, it certainly wasn't a normal life, and it wasn't a business either. I mean, we started a small nonprofit, and the idea was to try to bring American teaching hospitals and specific technologies related to like diagnoses of diabetes-related illnesses. Diabetes is a huge problem in Libya. And I felt like my experience there in the past was just drawing me back, that I couldn't not be involved and try to do something. After the intervention, I called Chris up and said, look, I'd love to come back and to the State Department and work for you. And we both knew that was sort of unlikely. He sort of laughed and said, yeah, you know, Ethan, by the time you get back in the system and could join, you'd probably be posted to Venezuela and I wouldn't see you for a few years. So I did the next best thing. And I had people around me who were similarly motivated. And yeah, looking back on it, I mean, it was sort of a crazy, in quotes, decision. I mean, you know, I was working in Dubai at the time, and my colleague basically just quit what we were doing and started making trips to Benghazi. If I look back on it now and try to figure out where that rational decision came from, it's not, it wasn't rational. It was a gut feeling, an instinct. And we followed it as far as we could. I mean, the time in Libya as a diplomat was one of the most interesting periods in my life. And it was a bit by, you know, I sort of wound up there a bit by accident in a way. You know, the Arabic speakers in the department were all sent off to, sucked up by the Iraq war, and there weren't, you know, I had just joined and I had Arabic and other things that were a background in resource economics and a stint in an oil company. So They're like, well, let's send you off as a new diplomat to Libya. And it seemed like no one else really wanted to go, which I thought was, Chris and I would sort of wonder at that. It's like, why wouldn't an experience like that, looking under the hood of Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, be fascinating? But, I think that's a bigger thing, is that, you know, particularly, I think the theme of risk is one that permeates the whole Benghazi story and the broader engagement with the Middle East. And you really can't, I know that Chris felt the same way, you can't engage with people if you can't talk to them and get out into the field. And the problem is that more and more risk has been stultifying everything. I think that's a number of officials in the Defense Department and other places in D.C. have described this as sort of the Benghazi effect, that this sort of pervasive risk aversion. Nobody wants to make the decision to do something that might trigger another political blowout and wind up yanking people in a committee. And that's that basically means that American foreign policy is hijacked to domestic politics. Like we don't have an independent foreign policy anymore. We're always worried about who's attacking us or who we're attacking at home. And that is one of the biggest threats to our position as a world power.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
We should have more dialogue with leaderships around the world to at least have an open phone line.
Well, that That too. I think over the years, both on the Democrat and Republican side, successive administrations have kind of eroded our bureaucracies and our, you know, the ties and the communication between the military, the State Department, and our security services. It doesn't work. It doesn't work very well. And that's one of the big problems with Benghazi was the fact that there were multiple sort of pockets of professional experts who had an opinion about what was going on there, but the information didn't seem to percolate up in a very efficient way. And at the highest level, there was this very deep justified concern that anything that was done would be fodder for political attacks. So there's sort of these defensive walls and these misaligned communications around basic intelligence. And so that opens up a whole other doors of discussion, but there it is.
Well, yeah, because after 2012, after this happened, it was used as a lightning rod. There was a lot of chatter about Benghazi, you know, and then we had the elections coming around in about 2015, 2016, you know, but all that chatter had just kind of carried over to it. A lot of blame was being placed on, you know, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, at the time. I believe she was Secretary of State, and what she was or was not doing according to, you know, popular opinion. I know that people close to me have lost personal best friends in that situation, and it's a very sensitive subject matter. And I too am a little upset that they lost their best friends, and friends have died, and friends had to defend each other to try to not die and try to recover, you know, Ambassador Stevens, you know, body, and, you know, to give him a proper send off as he deserves, you know, for being a selfless individual to go into a hostile environment where he didn't feel it probably as hostile it was becoming. He just knew that it was a powder keg, and he was trying to get in there and maybe defuse it. And it just got out of control. And that's me, the American's point of view, right? That's what I think, right? So I wasn't there again on the ground.
Well, the Chris Stevens and other names we know well are without a doubt heroes. The degree of professionalism and selflessness was extraordinary. I think everybody performed in a very difficult situation, you know, extremely well. But unfortunately, they didn't have the broader resources that to avoid what ultimately happened. But you know, Benghazi was a perfect, as I talk about in the book, Benghazi was a perfect scandal. I mean, you really couldn't have for a whole range of reasons, you really couldn't have designed an event or a machine that would disrupt the sort of the political space and our foreign policy as much as Benghazi did, and in sort of ways that aren't visible. I mean, 9/11, you sort of saw a lot of that was visible. Of course, there were layers beneath it, which we discovered more and more as time went by. But Benghazi has been reduced to this sort of event that ultimately a lot of noise and then not a whole lot of actual impact. And I think that's the biggest myth that I want to burst in this book. Benghazi had a huge impact. It hasn't been sort of, because of the political sensitivities and toxicity of it, it has not been given its due, which is ironic, of course, because precisely you would think that something that had 10 congressional committees looking into it and, you know, endless news and memes and tweets, etc., would be more defined, but it's not. We reduce it all to that period of time during the attack, and it's almost like there wasn't a before and there hasn't been an after.
It was just like that happened, and it just culminated to that situation. You know,
why was Benghazi such a powder keg? I think there are a few reasons. One is that it, of course, it took place on the anniversary of 9/11. It took place in the lead up to the presidential election, in which security issues were one of the prime areas of contention between Mitt Romney and Obama, and connected to so many other sort of issues, identity issues. It was also a period of time in which social media was evolving to the point where it had the capability to polarize much of the media and the general public to a degree that simply hadn't been around before. I mean, this is a factor that hasn't been discussed a lot, but I interviewed a number of data scientists and people follow social media trends and economics. And, you know, many of them have said that that period of fall 2011 was really the moment where social media and its algorithms came into its own as a tool of influence. Had the attack occurred a few months before or a year before, or whatever, that would not have played into So the combination of all of those things and the animosities that, that were stirring around, you know, that over for years at that point was just created something that, that
hashtag
was much more
memes, articles written off of the cuff of feelings, not of facts. You know, everybody wants to Rubik's Cube it into their own narrative so it just works for them. But there are like two sides to the story. It can be looked at that way. But nobody wants to hear the sides the way it went down. They want to continue to extrapolate that lightning rod, you know, and I'm not trying to, again, pick one side or the other. It's just true. And there's a lightning rod that is held to Benghazi. It has a nice, you know, it could be a nice town. It could still be a place where you can go and, you know, maybe try to live after it recovers from its situation that it's been through all these years of war. But, you know, yeah, I just don't like to see us polarize ourselves against one another.
Benghazi was the perfect means for America to essentially fall upon itself and start what I call the massive exercise in self-harm or cannibalism, maybe. A cartoon that was published in The Onion a few years ago, which showed a couple of jihadis sitting on a couch under the caption, watching TV, under the caption, FBI reports, finds plot by Al-Qaeda to sit back, relax, and watch America destroy itself. Which I think is, I mentioned that in the book, and I think that's a perfect summary of what the partisan, all of that has done to this country.
It's like, we'll gnaw our own leg off without even being trapped.
Right. Well,
it's like, we're not even trapped. We're not even in the trap. Like the wolf in the trap, he would gnaw his leg off for a reason. We're just gnawing our leg off.
That analogy could get pretty gruesome fast.
Just stop it. Yeah, I know. But, and but I'll let you continue to talk, please.
You know, if you think about it, Al-Qaeda, I mean, I'm sure there's been some debate as to what bin Laden and his deputy and then successor, Zawahiri, were thinking in terms of what they thought the consequence of 9/11 would be. And presumably, you know, that this extends to Benghazi, too. What did they expect that the United States would tie itself up in knots over launch a war in Iraq and become this twisted knot of partisanship? Because essentially, by allowing these conflicts to fester, we're essentially allowing our adversaries, not just Al-Qaeda, but other competitors and adversaries. Correct. Globally, to come in and move into the space which we previously had much more influence in. That pairs with the risk aversion. You know, we can't, and there's this pervasive feeling that we shouldn't be, you know, I can't tell you the number of people both on the right and the left that I've spoken with who say, you know, we shouldn't be in the Middle East at all. What has this region brought us other than conflict and misery and oil? But, you know, if we're not there, we can't have any influence. And regardless of what we do, the Middle East has such strategic and other influence on us that we wind up getting sucked in anyway. So we might as well have some, right. You know, I think if we abdicate the Middle East, we're abdicating our role as a superpower and our influence, which extends to all kinds of other areas, including, you know, issues related to the environment and climate and future of the world. Otherwise, we become just another one of these, you know, one of a number. And that's not what the United States has aspired to.
No.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
You know, I think that you hit on a good point. You know, knowing a language of your counterpart can go a long way. Having someone sent into a theater of operation to take over for somebody that speaks Arabic and does not speak Arabic is not going to go well. So if you send diplomats to these far-off regions that don't have an understanding of even to say hello or where's the bathroom or how do I get a drink of water in that other country's language, that kind of does a disservice.
Well, yes, this is part of the sort of loss of American expertise. I think you know, with all of this politicking comes a lot of political appointees and people who, and maneuvering based on a person's political views or affiliations or past opinions that really should not be a part of a cold calculation that's in American national interest. And we need many more experts. I mean, I think both the Iraq war, ironically, you know, I think the Iraq war and 9/11 boosted interest, general interest in studying languages and things like the Arabic, among others. But I don't think that that's translated into a long-term hard asset in terms of the number of people who are truly proficient in these languages and understand the region. I mean, from an analytical and have the analytical capacity to offer strong policy advice. I'm sure the number of people who are trained up in Arabic has, you know, in absolute terms has increased, but not nearly enough and not strategically enough. And I think that goes across the board. No, Americans.
I was going to say that, more civilians learning the language. I understand the military going through the Defensive Language Institute. You know, you're going to send guys to the DLI. They're going to go there and they're going to learn how to speak another language. They're going to get trained up on that for their job. Like a Green Beret is going to learn another language. You're going to learn this for that theater of operations that you're going to work in. You're going to learn how to work with those people. That's really great because they're working on like, you know, how to like save a nation from fighting each other and killing each other. But what we need is someone maybe who's not so, who's going through school right now in dual immersion, learning another language, who's an 11th grader who has fluent Chinese under her belt, who could possibly become a diplomat, okay, with, you know, educated words.
And a diplomatic corps that's capable of identifying and absorbing those people and compensating them at a reasonable level. I mean, you don't join the government, as they say, to get wealthy. But the amount of resources that are available to hire and train and search for people who would be able to serve our country in that capacity is not nearly enough. And it's constantly under threat.
Those listeners out there that are listening to us right now, who might be in school for a secondary language, they should maybe didn't think what they were going to do with it. Well, maybe you could be a diplomat. Maybe you're diplomatic, material. I'm just saying, you're saying it's like one of the best jobs you ever had.
Well, I should say the time that I had in Libya was extraordinary, and it was an extraordinary set of circumstances. I quickly realized that in my following posts, I mean, I had a tremendous also immersion program in Farsi, where essentially you could never get such a training anywhere else in that context. But the subsequent postings were much more sort of constrained and bureaucratic, if I could say, than I really liked being out in the field. I did not like being in a desk job. And I also realized that, in order to have the experience, it was almost like an inverted experience. In order to have the kind of experience that I had in Libya, I'd probably have to stay in the Foreign Service another 10 years to get that degree of exposure. And yeah, I this is a bit of a diversion, but in terms of your audience that might be considering going to work for the State Department or et cetera, I mean, I think that the system needs to change a bit in the sense that it would become attractive to someone, say mid-career, who has other skills, who could come in, do 4 years of service, and then go out. Part of the problem is that it's been cultivated as this, your one career. You join and you stay there forever. But people these days aren't looking for, and the world does not exist. That world doesn't really exist anymore. But as an early career or mid-career stint, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. You can get a master's degree in something that's covered by the State Department. You can learn another language to a serious degree, and you can get an exposure to the rest of the world that you would otherwise not have. And I think that and fellowships like the Fulbright and various other U.S. government fellowships to study abroad are just exactly what the kind of thing that the United States needs. People need to get out of their silos and go and live with other people and communicate with them. Your worldview changes completely.
Completely, completely. I've traveled around, been to a couple places, and I come back to America, and I'm always just like, okay, I'm back in America. We are who we are. We are, the gun-toting, protesting kind of American. It's like, come on, man. That's all. Come on. What do we got here? You go over to England or to London, and you walk that whole city. You walk like 30 miles so happily. You're just like, why is everything just so... I don't know. And you come back over here and everybody's kind of pissed off all the time. I come through immigration and he's like, who are you? Some kind of Navy SEAL duck commander. And I just looked at him and I said, does that get me into America? And he's like, come on in. I was like, they didn't say that to me in England. He's like, what's your purpose over here in England? My friend wrote on his, when you enter, enter a country, you have to write what you're coming in for. He had the notion to write international playboy. All right. So we go up. I write on, I'm in there for what I'm doing, and I go to the immigration officer and I'm like, I'm here to check into your country. He's like, oh, okay. You're going to be hosting a boxing match. I'm like, yeah. He's like, you making any money? I was like, no, it's for charity. He's like, come on in. He looks at my buddy. He's like, what's this, mate? Huh? International playboy. He thinks it's a joke. He's like, I've been to America. Do you think your international immigration would treat me the same way I'm treating you right now? And I was like, you know what? When I went back home, our guys were jerks. I'm an American. I straight up walked in. He's like, automatic name. What are you? A duck commander? And I'm like, bro, let's get over ourselves. All right. We all bleed the same blood on the inside. That's my opinion. Okay. Because prove me otherwise.
Yeah. I've had some interesting conversations on immigration lines as well.
I'm just like, that's just me saying that, call that out. But I think that with regards to Benghazi, and I do want to say a couple names. I want to say Glenn Doherty. I want to give his name, some foreverness on my program. All right. He's one of the SEALs that was lost as a contractor. Tyrone Woods. One of his battle buddies,
John,
I believe. They left the situation they were dealing with to try to get involved and help what was going on over at Ambassador Stevens' compound with a lot of the contractors that were there trying to defend the situation. And ultimately succumb to, you know, that firefight and the death that this was bestowed upon them, unfortunately. So, you know, I just want to give Glenn a shout out, and Tyrone, and all of the guys out there that did fight to bring everybody else home that was there, including themselves and their brothers next to them. I understand where you come from when you guys are like, you weren't there, man. You're right. I was not there. But I don't know if Michael Bay was there either. And I just want to say this. Did Michael Bay, before Benghazi came out, that movie, did he talk to you about anything about the movie? I'm just curious. Because that movie came out pretty quick.
No. Yeah, I thought that the book 13 Hours, I thought was a very useful and rather nonpartisan description, and very, very helpful. The movie was a bit not. And I felt that the treatment of Chris Stevens in particular was very inaccurate and somewhat disrespectful. But yeah, the part of the fascination and maybe a sense of outrage that Benghazi provoked was, in fact, this empathy with those four individuals that, you know, and admiration for their heroism. I think, you know, who would have the, you know, it takes a special person to be in that situation to begin with, and to do what they did was just admirable. There's nothing else to say. And the immediate reaction is always going to be, you know, why did this have to happen? And how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? And the instinct is to look for someone to blame. And of course, everybody started to look for someone to blame. But one hopes, and again, I keep emphasizing in the book, is that we have an opportunity here to look beyond these sort of details about which some of which will maybe never even be clear, and look at the context and how do we get here, and what damage has this been doing to our country and our institutions, whether the military, the State Department, et cetera. I mean, we cannot continue to be, to use that metaphor before, to sort of cannibalize ourselves over these issues and take the eye off the bigger issue. You know, what is our role in the world in the years to come?
Are they still conflicting over there right now with your sources? Do you have people on the ground that are like still chatting with you saying, hey, you know, we're not recovered from the situation? Is Libya trying to get back up on its two feet? What's your thoughts?
Well, but yeah, this is part of the issue, is that the impact of Benghazi on the ground in the Middle East has been spectacular. I mean, basically, if you look at Libya, we essentially went from intervening to protect Benghazi, a city of less than under a million people, from the wrath of Gaddafi, to handing the eastern part of Libya over to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It's not an optimal,
right.
by far an optimal outcome. And the whole democratic transition, the whole governance process, as fragile as it was to start with, and it's sort of hanging by a thread, was completely overturned. And Libya has been, in the course of the last 10 years, essentially set upon itself with various proxies fighting and adding more fuel to the fire. You know, Russia with influence in Libya, Turkey in the West, and various other proxies sort of circling around. And the Libyans have lost control to a large extent of their own destiny. That is, you know, for a country of 6.5 million people, that's an absolute tragedy. And the same could be said of Syria. I've had many discussions with people who are very intimately involved with aspects of Syria policy, and we still haven't cracked that nut. But basically, the United States was working proxies in both countries at critical points in their revolutions, and trying to pick between allies that we thought might be more moderate and steer away from those who were a bit more radical, but we really didn't know who was who. And Benghazi, essentially, as one well-known journalist said, she felt that Benghazi had killed the whispers of a strong Syria policy. And now that can be applied also to our approach to warfare in, like, Yemen, where we're relying much more on drone warfare and less on boots on the ground and in-person intelligence. And I know that there's been quite a bit of controversy within the military about whether that's, you know, the ultimate implications of that. And I also ask whether, in fact, our policy with respect to Iran may not have been influenced by Benghazi as well, because the Obama administration, you know, had suggested from the very start that had seen a nuclear deal with Iran to be a prize worth pursuing, and possibly one that would avert war. But given the way that things happened with the Benghazi attack politically, essentially, and with the arrival of the Trump administration, of course, the Iran deal was taken instantly off the table. And I don't think the Obama administration thought forward to that, even that possibility. And de facto, I would not be surprised if Iran has a nuclear weapons capacity very, very quickly.
Well, the international, you know, nuclear program was working with Iran when we had that nuclear treaty to make sure everything was going correct. You know, Libya's not nuclear, right? They're not a nuclear threat at this point that we're aware of.
No, and they were never really close to that. That's...
Yeah.
You know, Libya was used as a nuclear non-proliferation success in 2003, again, after in the wake of the Iraq war, something that we failed to find WMDs in Iraq, but we were able to divest Gaddafi of his nukes and chemical weapons, but he really had no advanced nuclear program. And he did have chemical precursors. Anyway, that's another... And again, sort of in the realm of politics.
Well, isn't nuclear medicine kind of like the same thing as nuclear capabilities? If you have, like, you know, the capabilities to have, you know, that harnessed for nuclear medicine, isn't there a need for nuclear to a point to where Iran and Libya could have those types of components to help their people versus like a bomb?
Well, I'm not sure about medicine, but I think power is certainly there's a better interface or connection with nuclear weapons capacity, and yeah, I mean, look, there's a fundamental that opens up a bigger issue: who is allowed to have nuclear power and weapons? You know, Pakistan is a nuclear power, and we don't, and there are certainly that presents the same kinds of issues that Iran would. Right. I'm not sure I want to venture into this topic so too deeply right
now. No, it's fine.
But I mean, my point was to say that you can't obviously redo the experiment of history, but Benghazi really had a number of impacts, broad impacts, through what I mentioned before, the sort of this pervasive risk aversion and the, you know, its impact on further impacting the partisan warfare in the United States that are significant. And we really don't give these days. Nobody wants to talk, you know, essentially it's interesting. At least the perception is that no one wants to talk about Benghazi. I think a lot of people don't want to talk about Benghazi because it doesn't seem to have a resolution. Like, it doesn't lead anywhere. It's just going to open up a fight over something to do with Hillary Clinton or, you know, and who's right and who's wrong about the video and all of this other stuff. But there are lots of things to talk about. And in fact, the things to talk about are how did the impact of that, those billowing clouds of partisanship that lasted for 44 plus years, that had an impact. And it had an impact on how we do things abroad. It has had an impact on America's, you know, performance and ability to assess threats. And I sort of talk about Benghazi as something of like a, if 9/11 was the sort of original sin, Benghazi was kind of, and the reaction to it, Benghazi was kind of like a signal booster, perpetuated the harmful dynamics without offering much of a solution. Yeah.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Yeah, it did. It just opened up that wound again because they hit us on 9/11. 9/11 just brings us back to the original 9/11. People then just polarize the Middle East as 9/11, and then 9/11 just gets this whole branding for let's go to war.
Friend and colleague who described America's response to the original 9/11 as something of we should have treated this not as a signal for ideological warfare, but a mass criminal act. And by going into that space of ideology and with us and against us and the war on, you know, the endless war on terror, etc., we managed to perpetuate the things that really should have been contained and addressed as, again, a more or less as a mass criminal act. And we still don't know.
You know, because it was.
Yeah, absolutely. But by essentially recognizing this, by giving fuel to the ideologues who launched the attack to begin with, that can only result in more harm to ourselves. And, you know, if you look at take the whole history from 9/11 to Benghazi and beyond, Al-Qaeda, with its strategic attacks, has managed to do more harm than I think they ever expected they could have done. Not just by their own hands, by our own responses.
Doing as well.
And if that's something, you know.
One another here in America, it's just an interesting, you know, what am I trying to say? Climate, I guess. You know, I talk to a lot of people in my industry and some people don't, they're like, Rad, you really think like that? And I'm like, well, think like what? Like giving water to my neighbor or maybe giving you a bandage if you cut yourself? Yeah, I think like that. You know, it's like, how hard is it to think like that? You know, my neighbor is my neighbor. And if something did happen here, I would have to defend him and he'd have to defend me. So why not just be neighborly with each other, you know, and instead of against each other, you know, I'm going to come tread across your front lawn if you have a flag on it. I promise you, I will walk across it. Okay, put it up there. I'll walk across it. If you're my neighbor, I don't care. What are you going to do? You know, I'm over that polarization of against one another as Americans. I don't want to gnaw our leg off anymore. We're not in a trap. Mm-hmm. Quit gnawing on your leg, you know, as a people. Not how I wanted to like kind of wind down our episode of frustration, but you know, we can.
While I was writing this book, I had this sort of fantasy of what would happen if Republicans and Democrats could be put, or some representative sample could be put in a room with some all-knowing mediator who could basically take the two partisan narratives around Benghazi, of which both have a mm-hmm. substantial amount of wrong, false material in them, and understand where, and be exposed isn't the right word, but maybe it is, to understand what of it is true and what of it isn't true. And I think that both sides would feel vindicated about some things and completely deflated on others. And it would be a productive exercise, but we can't, you know, catharsis, like, okay, well, you know, that the other side has recognized that we were right about this, but we have to take on the fact that we were wrong about that. I mean, this is the kind of truth and reconciliation process that we encourage other countries, which we think are less developed than we are.
Self-awareness.
But the problem is, of course, that it's increasingly unlikely that we could get to something like that because of the polarization, which in fact was spurred on by Benghazi itself. You know, you can't, if you're so stuck in your silo, nothing will penetrate. You know, the idea of, but it's been done before, you know, it's not a hopeless, and I think the alternative to this is just the United States spiraling into a shadow of its former self. So we have to find some way to block and overcome these domestic political warfare. So
it's unhealthy. You know, and I just want to say, Ethan, you know, very cool conversation. All right. I know we've been tricking about an hour now talking, and to my listener who's been listening this whole time, thank you for being a part of our conversation. And Ethan, I just know there's so much more knowledge, you know, the fact that you speak Farsi and that you know that whole theater over there so well. I would love to maybe reach out to you in another time and maybe let's give Gloria a shout out, okay? Because she is a boss, all right? Your friend Gloria reached out to me and says, you need to have him on your show. And I was like, Gloria, you keep sending me solid dudes like this and I will always open your email, okay? There is no problem there, Gloria. And I just want to give her a shout out. I don't think I said her name enough, Gloria.
Thank you, Red. I really appreciate having me on, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Tell me the name of your book from your mouth one more time.
Benghazi, A New History of the Fiasco That Pushed America and Its World to the Brink. I should memorize it so I can say it a little faster.
And with that, I want to say thank you to former diplomat Ethan Shorin for being a part of SofRep Radio with me today. And I am Rad, and happy 10-year anniversary to SofRep, and a humble anniversary to the Benghazi and 9/11 2001 tragedy. So thank you for being a part of SofRep Radio, and I look forward to talking to you again. Peace.
You've been listening to SofRep Radio.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s. Dance away with hip-hop beats and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.